Vodka O'Clock.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Vodka O'Clock. I'm your host, Amber Love from amberunmasked.com. Today, my guest and I will be talking openly and not graphically, but very openly about the treatment of women in pop culture networks and what it's like to be a public figure who has faced damaging gender-based attacks and why public figures like writers are defensive over the abilities to rebrand themselves with new names, you know, and when we're facing things like Google Plus and Facebook trying to remove your choice of identity. So if frank discussions about sex-based crimes disturb you, you may want to skip this episode and look up pictures of kittens. You know, that's what we're going to be talking about today. And you can welcome my guest, Christine Rose. Thanks for joining me.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Amber.
I'm really glad that you're able to speak openly about the troubled history that you have in subculture, because it really does, I believe in my heart, it helps other victims of harassment and assault come forward. I know that's personally because when one of my friends became very open about her rape issues suddenly, then I felt much easier to talk about my own mm-hmm. past, because I had just buried it for 20 years mm-hmm. and I knew. Mm-hmm. So I had discovered you because of your old blog where you talked openly about being a rape survivor and an advocate for safety policies. So since this year, we're 2014, and this year we've seen women threatened over criticizing comic books, reporting on video games, and then we've seen big name celebrities get attacked simply for existing and having their photos stolen.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think it's really important to point out that this year we're seeing coverage of those things. It has been prevalent for, oh my goodness,
going on.
Yeah, and what I'm really happy about now is that we're actually seeing coverage. You know, there people are talking about it. The media is picking it up. You know, people are blogging about it. People are speaking more openly about it and saying, you know what, this has got to stop, and we are not going to be silent about it anymore.
And you know, and sometimes you know, hackers are their own anarchy community in kind of a way. But you know, sometimes they can save the day, like in the Steubenville.
For the Steubenville rape case, you know, if your listeners aren't familiar, I really encourage you to look that up. The thing with Steubenville was that America reacted as if it was an anomaly. They reacted right. as like, oh my God, this, how could this happen? And this poor girl and all those poor boys, or, you know, whatever site you were on. But what they fail to recognize is that happens every single weekend at countless high schools across the country and colleges and other communities. What the difference with Steubenville was the anonymous anarchist group, Anonymous, picked up the story, because it was months after this happened. It was when the football coach was already burying it. The town was burying it. There was like one woman who was keeping it alive, and someone in Anonymous picked it up and leaked it. And that's why anyone heard of that, was because it was leaked, not because it was an anomaly, because that one was leaked.
Right, because there was, you know, there's a lot of different issues that come out with a subject like this. First of all, it was the protection of athletes and how revered they are, and then, which, you know, we've been seeing in the NFL ridiculously this year.
Mm-hmm.
And but also racial issues, mm-hmm. because it's just in the past week and a half, two young girls from Florida who happened to be black girls were horribly murdered.
Oh, my God.
And they were strippers.
Mm-hmm.
So it got some coverage from the more fringe websites like Jezebel.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not the sort of thing that you're going to see on Good Morning America, where you saw coverage for Steubenville.
No, it's not. And one of the reasons that is, I know when I was doing a lot of research into rape culture and into community response, you know, and cultural response to sexual violence, I came across an article of, it wasn't Lorena Bobbitt, who is, of course, the one whose name is now synonymous with, you know, for what she did to her husband in cutting his penis off. it was like 20, 25 years ago or something now. What is forgotten, of course, about Lorena Bobbitt's case is that he raped her first, and that's why she retaliated in that way. Of course, it's really a horrific way, you know, to retaliate. But what is forgotten is that he assaulted her first. Anyway, so I came across this article about another woman who had done the same thing, had cut her husband's penis off. And it was covered by every news organization, you know, across the, certainly locally, you know, it was in Southern California, but also across the country, about what a horrific crime this was. And of course it is. It is a horrific crime. However, something like 800 women are raped every single day in the United States. And what really got me so much about this article about the woman who cut her husband's penis off is that the leading detective was talking about how gruesome it was and how awful it was and how he had only seen one other case. He could only remember one other case, meaning Lorena Bobbitt, in his lifetime. So we are talking about two in the past 25 years when, you know, this kind of horrific level of sexual violence was taken, was perpetuated by a woman against a man in this way. And what you don't see is the 800 women that are raped every single day in this country. And it's because it's not news. It happens so much and it is so extremely commonplace that it is not news.
And that's what a lot of the discussion is surrounding verbal harassment or even physical harassment, like the catcalling and
street harassment.
The Sam Pepper YouTube channel. I don't know if you
heard that.
It literally just happened in the past few days. Apparently, he's a figure who has been on YouTube for quite a while and harasses women physically and verbally, and then says it's a social experiment to show you what happened.
Oh, I see. Yeah, I think I did. I've heard about, if it wasn't him, it was a real similar YouTube channel. But go on. Yeah, I mean, it's...
Also, then the right people became aware of it, you know, people like Lacey Green and Will Wheaton. And once you start getting recognition by the people who are prominent on the internet, then it... there's more awareness about it. And now his network has kicked him off. I mean, he's gotten kicked off YouTube, but he was, you know, apparently like part of a larger network.
Good. Well, and that's what needs to start happening. There need to be social consequences for this type of behavior.
Right. And it's just, but it's one of those things where, you know, it's so common. And some of the problem is people go, oh, but look how she's laughing when he grabs her ass. It's like, do you not understand the difference between nervous and uncomfortable smiling and laughter? It's there, and some people don't understand that.
That's not enjoying it, or even if she thinks she's enjoying it, she's been socialized for decades to just brush it off and say, oh, this is just what happens. I remember when I told my mother about a professor who sexually assaulted me when I was 20 years old. He was 45. And he would corner me in his office and he would tell me things like, oh, every time I look at you in class, you know, I really want to F you. And, you know, things like this. And, you know, and he would make me touch him. I was 20, you know, I was 20 years old. And, when I told her that, you know, this had happened to me several years later, she goes, yes, well, you know, of course you're a woman. That's just what happens. And it's just one of these things that is accepted as a part of being a woman because no one, you know, because it's like, well, it's just the way it is. So, you know, be thankful he didn't rape you or be thankful he didn't whatever, you know, or be thankful that it wasn't worse. You know, and it was the same thing when I was, I remember it was something similar when I was, when a doctor was sexually harassing his patients. And what's funny about, what's funny, not like ha-ha funny, certainly, but what's interesting about a lot of these cases is that it is so socially acceptable that a lot of women don't even realize that they've been harassed or assaulted when it would fit the legal definition of meaning these things. I mean, I was reading some statistics not too long ago where it's something like only 28% of women whose incidents meet the legal definition of rape consider themselves rape victims. because they have been so socialized to, and of course everyone around them, including the police, continuously minimize sexual assault and sexual harassment, that they just have to blow it off or just cope or just whatever, unless it is like the most brutal form of stereotypical rape. Then,
right.
You know,
that's what
you just minimize it, you dismiss it. And so does everyone around you.
They expect it to be a stranger in an alley.
Exactly. With some sort of weapon, jumping out of bushes, or, you know, and this is like the very narrow definition.
Right.
Of rape.
But I went through recently with a friend of mine who it was right as she had one relationship ending, she went on a date with somebody, and then it was before her next stable relationship began. And she went on this one date, and we couldn't figure out why she was, her internet posts were suddenly so strange, and what was wrong, and was it just the breakup? And, you know, suddenly then she texted me, and she said, I have to ask you something. And I went, okay. And she explained in detail how she went on the date with this guy, how he was friendly to her before, like she would have thought of him as a friend. And after saying no to him so many times, she basically just like gave up saying no. And she's like, was this wrong? Mm-hmm. I'm like, yes, it was
coercive
wrong.
Rape. Sure. It's coercive rape.
And I'm like, you said no, more than once. Mm-hmm. He's clearly an asshole.
Yeah. Well, and a rapist. Yeah.
And a rapist. Yeah. He's a criminal. He is now. Yeah. I mean, you know, but these are the sorts of things that are not reported.
Well, especially when it's coercive rape like that. And the woman says, or the person, of course, it's not always a woman, the person says no. And they say, once is enough. But if they repeatedly say no over several hours or ever, you know, and that there is, whenever you hear the word force, generally you think of overwhelming, brutal force. But force is struggling. Force is someone who's trying to take your shirt off and you're trying to hold it down. And they are overpowering you to get it off. And
But when you're not
that's
even
force, you know, that's it's clearly that you don't want them to do this. They are struggling against you to do it anyway. That is force. You know,
and that stuck in people's head. That's the only valid.
I'm sorry.
I said that's what's stuck in people's head as being the only valid definition.
Exactly.
When, you know, if you know, in cases of being unconscious,
right?
You,
oh, geez.
You're not fighting back. You're not saying no because you're not saying anything.
Well, you're not saying anything because you're incapable of consent because you're unconscious. Or if you're too inebriated, you're incapable of consent. You know, and so that's what, you know, a lot of people will. I find. There's rape, what is commonly known as rape apologists, which people who make excuses for rapists, like if you take your friend's example, because that's actually extremely similar that what happened to me with the steampunk musician who I speak about pretty openly on both the Order of the White Feather blog, which is wearawhitefeather.wordpress.com, as well as my former pen name I used to write under O.M. Gray in the steampunk community, which is when all this happened. And that's omgray.wordpress.com. I write a lot about the steampunk musician, and that's what happened with him. I have a post called No Means No, and I said no and no and no for 5 hours. I mean, I'd struggle with him at every step of the way. I tried to physically leave the room twice. And he physically blocked me from leaving the room twice. Okay. This was like after I didn't even want to go back to his hotel room. I told the cab driver to take me to the station. And he said, absolutely not, take us here. You know, and it was like, you know, and I liked this guy. I liked him. He was a colleague. I really, you know, I fancied him. I was, but I didn't want to do this for several reasons, you know, ethically being one of them, because he, you know, has a partner and a children. And I'm like, look, this is not okay. You know, and I'm married too. I have a husband, but we were in a polyamorous relationship. We were in an open relationship and I'd already cleared it with him. But as soon as I found out that this person was not free, I'm like, this can't happen. But he just kept going and kept going and kept going. And he'd say, you know, we don't have to do anything you don't have to do. It's just, you know, just whatever. And of course, we don't have to do anything I don't want to do, even though I don't want to do any of it. And he's continuously pushing and continuously forcing and continuously struggling with me and, you know, emotionally manipulating me, etc. And I said, no, I can't tell you how many times I said no that night and tried to physically leave and so forth. And people don't look at that as rape, but that's exactly what it is.
Right. Now,
and because it happens so often, this kind of coercive thing, then it's always the person who's saying no that's blamed. It's, well, you didn't say no forcefully enough, or you didn't say, you know, or you didn't struggle enough, or you didn't fight back enough, or whatever. It's not enough. And what I always find, I'm sorry, I keep running over you.
Oh, that's okay. It always seems to be up to the victim.
Yeah.
Be defensive to
be defensive enough, but not too much.
Oh, you should take self-defense. No, I should.
Yeah, or not even, because I've seen the other things. It's like when a woman is brutally raped and she comes out of it with broken bones and bloodied face and black and blue and so forth and so on. What do people say to her?
They'll say that she asked for it.
They say, well, you shouldn't have struggled so much. You shouldn't have fought back so hard. You wouldn't have been so hurt.
Or, yeah, what was the politician's quote? Oh, it was the
rain? Rape is like a good rain. Yeah, it was back in the 80s. Rape is like a good rain. You know, it's inevitable, so just lay back and enjoy it.
The one that said, let it happen.
Yeah, lay back and enjoy it. Oh, yeah, it's inevitable. Yeah. Lay back and enjoy it.
Just let it happen, and then you'll be done.
Yeah, yeah. Just get it over.
God's will. That was the other, you know, it's God's will, obviously.
Oh, the God's will bullshit. Yeah, yeah. So, you know, so it's like rape targets, rape victims, rape survivors are seriously damned if they do and damned if they don't. If they don't fight back strongly enough, then they're blamed for not fighting back strong, for not being clear because, oh, well, maybe he was confused. Well, I don't know what no means in your language, especially hours of no's and hours of struggles mean in your language, but I think it means no, you know, let alone just silence, which is also not consent. Silence is not consent. You know,
right.
It has to be enthusiastically, yes. I mean, and don't have to. I remember the, you know, back when PC was kind of coming into vogue in the mid-90s, Saturday Night Live had this fairly offensive skit where, you know, there was a man and a woman together, like in a bedroom or a dorm room or something, you know, and at every stage he was like, may I put my right hand on your left breast, you know, and she would have to give him the affirmative consent before he could do that, or it would be considered, quote, sexual assault or whatever, which is, of course, absurd. You can tell if your partner is into it or not. You can tell, I mean, if you're not treating them like a sexual object or an ejaculatory tool, you can tell if they are engaged in the encounter. If they are meeting you, or if they are pushing you away, if they are pulling you towards them, or they are pushing you away, if they are saying no, or just not saying anything, or they're saying, oh, hell yes, baby, let's do this, you know? It doesn't have to be yes at every stage.
The language and the nonverbal cues are why it's really hard when things are put down in either presented, like on TV shows, or in writing, these really stupid, horrific, pickup artists.
Oh God.
Mentalities. Because there was a TV show for a couple years, and then, I mean, there's countless books about it, and one of them had gotten funded through Kickstarter.
Mm-hmm.
And
I remember that one. Yeah.
Now no longer allows that, but and part of that is the language. Mm-hmm. Like the guy defended himself saying, "Oh, you're just reading that one sentence out of context," mm-hmm. whereas at the beginning of the chapter, I said, okay, if things are going according to plan, mm-hmm. and she's on board, now proceed to this. But it's a difficult thing to say, okay, well, you have the, you know, freedom of speech to write that down because, you know, whatever, do what you want to do. But it's an educational tool. That means other men are picking this up.
Mm-hmm.
And thinking that his instructions are acceptable.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, absolutely. And I'm glad that you brought up freedom of speech, because I'm going to talk a bit about freedom of speech, and I'm going to talk a bit about innocent until proven guilty, because these are two things that are really thrown out quite often in this discussion, especially when you're talking, you know, cultural and community responses of how communities respond to an accusation or information regarding a sexual, an incident of sexual violence, whether that be harassment, assault, or rape. And everyone is like, well, innocent until proven guilty. You know, I mean, what can we do? And what you have to remember with both freedom of speech as well as innocent until proven guilty is this is, the freedom of speech comes into play when you are not going to be arrested for something you say. Doesn't mean you're not going to have social consequences for something you say. It doesn't mean that you can say whatever you want and people are going to still want to be your friend and still invite you to their parties or still have you as a musical guest at their convention, for example. It means you're not going to be arrested for what you say. That's what freedom of speech is.
Right. I think that's really important to clarify because people don't understand why we want to report them on Facebook and Twitter and, you know, and message board systems for being.
And that's really interesting because we can't speak out. We can't name our attackers without facing legal consequences. And so where is our freedom of speech as survivors? Where is our freedom of speech of being able to say what happened to us and name our experience and name our attackers?
Right. I mean, there's a whole internet that you can go to. I mean, now there's, you know, the Reddit and 4chan are like the cesspools of humanity. And when they wander their way over to Twitter, it's, you know, they start the name calling, the, you're a cunt.
Mm-hmm. And, yeah, well, a lot of the misogynistic, speech rhetoric comes in, rape culture rhetoric.
My freedom of speech and I'm not violating anything. And it's like, well, you know, let's have someone in charge of this website determine what you're violating or not.
Yeah, you're not going to be arrested for saying what you're saying, but it doesn't mean I want you in my chat room or I want you in my community. And that's where I think that people in communities have a lot of power. And I know with this new White House campaign of It's On Us is a pretty powerful because it's promoting bystander response, and that's what needs to happen. And certainly it is, the bystanders are not responsible for a sexual predator's actions. The only person responsible for choosing to assault or rape someone is the rapist or the sexual predator, the perpetrator. However, the next person in line, the next people in line for of responsibility is the culture surrounding them, and is the subculture, the community surrounding them. As long as they turn their heads, as long as they are going to give the benefit of the doubt to the accused, to the perpetrator, and not to the survivor, they are perpetuating rape culture, and they are continuing to give the rapist a social license to operate because there is no consequences. There are no consequences for these people. Only 3% of rapists ever see a single day in jail in this country. Only 3%. Rape is extremely difficult to prove because there's generally only two people in that room. And unless there's significant physical evidence, which there almost never is, because 85% of rapes occur by someone that the victim knows, boyfriend, husband, friend, friend's brother, whatever.
Not to mention the 100,000 rape kits that are backlogged.
Oh, yes. Well, yes. Or to mention the way that the police minimize reports to make them not sexual assault, because then that helps their numbers, because they don't want if they know something can't be proven in a court of law, then they're going to minimize it and not even file it as a sexual assault, because it's going to make their department look bad for the number of sexuals, because it's already so low. And so they minimize them. So what communities have an extreme amount of power here, and I talk about this a lot on the Order of the White Feather page, which is wearawhitefeather.wordpress.com. And I talk about community response. I talk about how we can just switch one simple thing around. Right now, if someone says, so-and-so assaulted me, what we do, because we are all reading from a cultural script that tells us to say these things, because this is what we've heard everywhere we turn. Daniel Quinn would call it, Ishmael's author, Daniel Quinn would call it mother culture. On every television show, in newspapers, it's what we hear on the news, it's what we hear our colleagues and our parents and everybody say. We're reading from a cultural script, and we need to turn that cultural script on its head. So when someone says so-and-so assaulted me, right now the benefit of the doubt goes to the perpetrator. And you hear things like, well, you don't want to ruin someone's life, or, oh, she's probably just lying, or she's exaggerating, or she was just confused, or it's none of my business, or I mean, my goodness, you know, the excuses, the rape apology goes on and on. And the one, and any questions that are asked to the victim. Well, why were you there? Well, maybe did you lead him on? Did you say no? Did you fight back? I mean, the questions are endless to the victim. And what needs to happen is we need to turn those questions around and we need to question the accused. I'm not saying condemn the accused. I'm saying question. What happened?
It's extremely difficult in cases of marriage or relationships or for sex workers.
Mm-hmm.
People don't believe that sex work can be assaulted.
Yes, especially, yes.
Like what, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Now, one of the things I wanted to get to was the fact that, you know, you were a public figure.
I was.
And so I wanted to know what has this done to your career, because it
it's destroyed my career.
Yeah.
Yeah, destroyed my career. It destroyed my life for several years. I'm just now coming out of it. You know, this happened in 2011, 2012.
I was lucky to have met you in person at one of the conventions, and you know, and you've said that you don't want to go into the convention scene.
I don't want to. Because this is in steampunk, so your listeners, you know, can have context. This is in the steampunk community, and I wrote for many years under the pen name O.M. Gray, Olivia Gray. As I mentioned earlier, my blog there is O.M. Gray, that's grey.wordpress.com. And the post that you will see at the top now is RIPOMG, and it's when I killed off that pen name, O.M. Gray, and the reasons why I killed off that pen name. And the reasons are quite simple. I mean, when I came out, O.M. Gray was a marketing experiment. I write under Christine Rose as well with my husband. I write middle grade fantasy. But when I started writing steampunk, I wrote steampunk erotica and teen romance for a while under O.M. Gray. And I started writing it as a marketing experiment because steampunk was a very interesting genre for me. It was kind of up and coming. I really kind of had this, you know, sexy story I wanted to tell, and I didn't want to tell it under the same name because, you know, I had 12-year-old fans, you know, from the other books. So I created this pen name as an experiment, and it was a very successful experiment. I mean, with that summer, I was an Amazon bestseller, gothic romance bestseller. I've won several awards as O.M. Gray, several Reader's Choice Awards. I've run awards for my poetry, for the short fiction, for the novels, you know, etc. And when this happened with this steampunk musician who is a very popular steampunk musician in 2011, it really kind of started to halt that. It cut the rise of my career. I mean, it stunted, you know, the growth, because after all that went down, you know, everywhere I turn, people are talking about this musician, and he's being celebrated, you know, at convention after convention, and celebrated with guest of honor status. And, you know, I started speaking out about it, and I started like writing to conventions. And there were people I had a handful of supporters who really made a big difference. One of them, a wonderful, wonderful woman, made a big difference when she wrote to the Alliance of Steampunk Conventions speaking about, you know, this individual, who had, sexually assaulted me, really, you know, it was technically rape, technically digital and oral rape, about this, because there had been at least one other complaint about this person. And she had written to the Alliance of Steampunk Conventions, and four of them wanted more information. And I told them, you know, I was fine to give them more. I'll give them as many details as they want. And four of them wrote to me, and it was a Steampunk World's Fair, Wild Wild West, SteamCon, and I'm sorry, the fourth one is like eluding. It may have just been those three. It may have just been those three that wrote to me, because I can't. It must have been. And it was. It was four people, and two of them were with the same convention. That's what it was. So it was Wild Wild West Con, SteamCon, which is now defunct, and I'm happy about it for the reasons you're about to hear, and Steampunk World Fair.
Yeah.
And I wrote to them and I told them exactly what happened because, you know, as a survivor, as any survivor knows, you're called a liar so very much, you know, or that you're exaggerated, whatever, you know, you're dismissed. I lost friends. I lost my community. I ended up having to leave the state in which I was living in. And anyways, it's a long story. Give up my job, everything, really, just my entire life. And I wrote to them. I told them exactly what happened, because I didn't just say he raped me, because what's going to come to mind is stereotypical rape. And I didn't want to be called a liar, you know, if they found out the details. And so I told them everything that happened. I told them detail after detail. I was like, you know, I understand that, you know, this is what's happened, and you need to protect the people at your, you know, don't celebrate this rapist. And only one of them, and that was the Steampunk World's Fair, which is why I ended up meeting you there, why I ended up doing that show, because they came forward and said, he will not be here ever again. And he was supposed to be here this last year too, and they canceled him.
Wow. Yeah, I'm really happy to hear that, because it's always one of my questions whenever I do a pre-show interview with them, is talk about their safety
staff.
Yeah,
absolutely. And yeah, so we worked a lot with Jeff, you know, coming up to that and so forth. And I really started to feel like I might actually be able to do this again. You know, if there were people who were going to support me here several, you know, 3 years later, that I might actually be able to do this again. And so it gave me a little bit of hope there for a short time, but it ended up not working out. But the other two, SteamCon and Wild Wild West Con, both of those organizers said, I am so very sorry. We take sexual assault very seriously, but our hands are tied. And
yeah,
they
SteamCon
both
has a bad reputation.
Oh, yeah. They both honored him with guest of honor status. So they are not only allowing a rapist at their conventions, but they are honoring him with guest of honor status. And that's the reality of the rape culture in which we live. And this is why, I mean, it ended up, you know, killing my career, because I can't be at these places where my rapist is. And right. If they are, you know, and if the communities will not say, you know, if they're just going to, you know, repeat this innocent till proven guilty, or she's vindictive and she's out on a personal vendetta and all these other things they've been saying about me, you know, it's like, I don't need these people. It's not like, you know, I mean, my career is in the trash. I'd have to restart it, you know, from the beginning anyway. And I'm not going to do it in the same place where my rapist is and where people support my rapist. People who know what he did support him.
Right.
I'm not going to be there anymore.
One of the conventions even had, you know, the very same accusations against the person who was one of the head organizers, like the president of the board or something.
Uh-huh.
And he was eventually...
NASCAR-Con.
Yeah, that's, and he was eventually pushed aside. Meanwhile, his wife was like still on the board,
yep.
So he was still sort of planning on being there. And, you know, like he wasn't actually going away. It was sort of like, it took 10 years. Let me give the perspective here. It took 10 years for Edward Kramer to be officially removed from Dragon Con after molesting boys.
Yep. And how many people were molested during that time because no one said, hey, you know what? We don't want you. I don't care if it's true or not.
Yeah.
If someone is coming forward about it, by the way, you know, false accusations, it's a myth that it is common. False accusations are for sexual violence is less than false accusations for any other crime. It's around 2%.
Mm-hmm.
People don't make this stuff up. It's humiliating.
Yeah, why would you want to do that? Why would you want...
Very, very few people make stuff up.
And have people doubt you and have people call
you
names.
Yeah, exactly. What have I gained from this? I lost my career. I lost my community. I lost my job. This is what I, you know, this is the attention that I wanted by coming forward.
Yeah.
You know, so it's absurd that...
So the conventions, it is very important. It's imperative. For them to maintain safe environments. And I, you know, because they're so different, like the steampunk shows are often smaller scale. They're in hotels. Comic book shows are in large convention halls. And, you know, hotel has their own staff. Convention centers have a security staff. But then the conventions themselves will have volunteer staff.
Mm-hmm.
So these
mm-hmm.
people are not necessarily, like, I don't know what their training is. You know, I don't know if they have any training. I would hope that they would, but, you know, it's probably pretty unlikely.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that
most of them are fan-run. Like, most of them are volunteers,
I mean,
yeah.
So, you know, New York Comic Con, finally, because San Diego, I've never attended San Diego, but San Diego Comic Con would not enhance their policy for safety and harassment because they felt that a small, brief statement saying, if you run into a problem, find security. Sure. They felt that was enough to say because they didn't want to be specific. So the organization Reed Pop runs the New York show and Chicago, a show in Chicago and a couple others. They were confronted by women mostly who said, look, you know, San Diego wouldn't do anything. What are you willing to do about your policy? Because they had one, but it was the first time I ever heard of this was they sought out an independent panel of, I think, 7 or 8 different people and asked for them to work on the policy for them. So they had all of these women giving their input in between, like, it's on the MarySue.com to, if you want to look up the backstory of it. But now New York Comic Con has a brand new policy. It's not all that long.
Mm-mm. And it doesn't have to be. No, it doesn't have to be long, right?
Be long. It doesn't have to say if you are here and if you are drinking this and if you are wearing this.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to say, you know, it's like a list. Don't do any of these things.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this applies to everybody, whether you're a guest, a volunteer, an attendee, you know, a member of the staff. Like, it is concise and perfectly acceptable, and yet they're the first convention mm-hmm. to put together an independent panel like this.
Well, hopefully they're the first of many, because I know other conventions have been really kind of ramping up their harassment policies, and they've been getting a lot of flack from the people that, you know, that go there. But it's always the same kind of people. The people who have problems with anti-harassment policies are the ones who are doing the harassing. They're the ones who don't. They're the ones who are trying to protect their way of life, their behavior.
And whether, you know, you can have panels. Discussion panels at the shows about safety, and we can have podcasts like this, and we can have news coverage. But the people who need to learn from it are not going to be the ones learning from it.
No, it's not. That's why, you know, I can really get behind some of these, you know, because I just read an article that was like, okay, it's on us to go beyond it's on us, which is the White House campaign, you know, the hashtag it's on us about bystander response, you know, and there was Melissa McEwen, who I highly admire and respect for all of her writings on the subject, you know, mentioned saying that, okay, so now we're switching from victim blaming to bystander blaming or to culture blaming. And I can see your point in that. Okay. It's, there really is no one at fault except for the choice made except the perpetrator. However, I think that by changing our knee-jerk cultural response by no longer accepting that kind of behavior, we are going to close off huge sections of society where these kinds of people, where rapists, can operate. We're saying if they're the ones who are going to be examined, if they're the ones who are going to be questioned for their behavior, then that's going to deter the behavior in many of the cases. I mean, I think to this day, it's been 3 years. I don't think one single person has asked Paul, what happened? Tell me what happened. Not one person. He just keeps pretending that it hasn't happened. You know, not one single person has asked him. And
your career has taken so many changes, because I know from reading your posts, it was, you know, there were months when you weren't even there. I don't even think you posted for quite a while.
No, or all I could do for several years, all I could do was read about rape culture and read about other survivors' experiences and just try to make some sense of what had happened and to process it and to recover from it. I mean, I didn't work for 2 years. I mean, if it wasn't for my husband, I don't know if I'd still be here today.
Right. And that's, you know, the PTSD is...
Oh, the PTSD has been debilitating, yes.
Yeah. And that's unfortunately another thing that you hear about, you know, the you know, whatever trauma people go through, because it's a PTSD, you know, encompasses a general term, mm-hmm. but, you know, like that little girl who was just stabbed by her classmates, mm-hmm. you know, and there's no pressure for her to go back to school, but she misses school. So at least that's something where she's not just turning inward mm-hmm. and hiding, like she's out of the house and she goes and mm-hmm. plays kitten by herself.
And the reason she's able to do that is because she has community support.
Yeah.
Because absolutely. It was a very physical, very visual attack, you know, where everyone could say, oh yes, that happened, because we can see the wound. We can see the blood.
Proof. And the girls who did it are not denying that they did it.
Okay. Yeah. And so, yeah. you know, I know that as a survivor, and I've spoken with countless other survivors who say the same thing, the assault was traumatic. The treatment by the person that, you know, you respected and cared for, you know, to do that sort of thing and then just cast you aside is traumatic. What was as traumatic, if not more so, was the cultural response, was the way the police handled it, was the way your friends, or I use that term very loosely in this case, handled it.
Right.
The way your community handled it, that was as traumatic. Being labeled a liar, saying that you're vindictive, saying that you were, you know, whatever, that you're exaggerating. Oh, it's just a case of love gone kaplooey. You know, I mean, all these things. That was as, if not more, damaging.
Did you have to close off comments and try to, you know, do things to protect your website?
Oh yeah. I started getting very good at deleting people and blocking people, which was something I would never do before, because I was a very, very nice person. I think people who knew me before all of this and people who know me now, I seem very different. I probably seem very cold and cynical. And I am. Because, you know, who I was before was murdered.
Mm-hmm. And you are a different person.
Yeah. Yeah,
and now it's important for you to identify as a different person. So I want to know
I mean, I don't hesitate. I don't care who they are. I don't care what kind of history we've had, how long we've been friends, if we've known each other for 30 years, if they've been supportive in the past. I don't care. If they start giving me misogynistic, rape culture, victim blaming rhetoric, they're gone in a heartbeat. I just will not put up with it anymore. They're just gone. I delete them, you know, I block them from Facebook. Any trolls just don't even have a chance. I just don't even give them the chance, you know, to comment on things, unless I'm going to make an example out of them, which I've done.
I've done that too. Yeah. I'll be like, okay, I'll let you prove to the world that you are indeed a dickhead.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There is a
recapture it and throw it on Twitter. Absolutely.
Exactly. And I've done that. I've done screen captures. You know, and put it up on where, Order of the White Feather, you know, wearwhitefeather.wordpress.com, put it up on there. There's an article on there called Slut Shaming and Victim Blaming, because of a comment that I had gotten questioning my my story and questioning, you know, it's like, well, you know, you seem to whatever, you know, and I pulled it apart piece by piece. And it was at least a fan of Elementals, if not him himself writing this, because it was from San Diego Comic-Con where he was at that time. Yeah. So there is something, you know, and I recognize that, you know, I saw the IP address. I saw exactly where it was coming from. I knew, you know, what was going on, and I publicly laid it out and tore their, you know, little victim blaming tirade apart piece by piece.
So now as a professional writer, and you, I mean, you're already going through your own therapeutic process for healing from all of this. When did it occur to you to leave your genre where you were known and where you were happy previously, and give up your name and take a new identity? Were they at separate times, or was this something that...
it was a process. Over the last couple of years, you know, it was, you know, at first, because I wrote erotica, but I can't talk about sex anymore. I can't watch sex. I certainly can't write about it anymore. I can't even have sex anymore. So, you know, it kind of, is a killer for a romance writer, you know, to not be able to write about romance or about love or about seduction or about sex, you know, because all I can write about, if I write about sex, it's about assault. Mm-hmm. As you'll find out in the sequel to Avalon Revisited, which was my award-winning, best-selling book, the erotic romance, steampunk erotic romance, the sequel Avalon Revamped, is what it's about. It's about a succubus who is a champion for violated women. And it's about a serial rapist, and it's about different types of assault. And it's because that's all I could write. And it was a very cathartic book, actually. It was a very cathartic book to write. It was actually probably the doorway of me kind of becoming functional in society again. I wrote it early 2013. And I wrote a lot about assault and a lot about exploitation and the way that, you know, the police and the community behaves and so forth, and the way that these sociopaths and narcissists and other types of sexual predators do get away with this thing, you know, these things. So that was very cathartic, but, and I finished up what I had to write, you know, sequels of things that were already out. But then I just found like I really had nothing else to say. And then, you know, once when the word got out and I was speaking much more openly and identifying the perpetrator in privately to these steampunk conventions, and nothing was changing with the exception of AnomalyCon in Denver, they were wonderful, and Steampunk World's Fair, as well as the ones that Mickey Flint runs in Florida. With the exception of those three, also Aetherfest in San Antonio wouldn't have him back either. But except for those four, all the rest of them in the country, they don't care. They don't care enough to say, no, we're not going to have them, because they fall onto the, well, innocent till proven guilty rhetoric. And what people don't realize, which I touched upon a little bit before, is that the whole innocent till proven guilty, number one, it is not a constitutional right. It is not in the Constitution anywhere. Number two, that's another way of saying it's basically innocent till proven guilty, you know, beyond a shadow of a doubt, or, you know, due process. You have the right to due process. Innocent until proven guilty only is valid in a court of law. It is not.
These are all legal terms.
Yeah, it is not valid in society. It is not valid at steampunk conventions. You know, at parties, you don't have to, you know, hold a court hearing with a jury of your peers to decide whether or not to invite someone to your party or to invite someone to your convention. Okay, this is not innocent until proven guilty. We make choices. We make social choices every single day based on much, much less than the kind of information, detailed information that I was giving these people. You know, we make social, we make decisions. Oh, I want to go here. I don't want to go here. I want to go to this party. I want to invite this person, but I don't want to invite this person for far less information than the kind of information I gave in the detail publicly on my blogs and the detail of that night, as well as privately, even more so to some of the organizers, you know. And for them to just say, oh, well, you know, our hands are tied. Well, bullshit, your hands are tied. You don't want to lose the money that he brings in. And so if money is more important than the safety of your congoers, of the safety of your community, if your money is more important than perpetuating rape culture and celebrating a known rapist, then I want nothing to do with you.
Right. And one of the things that seems to happen in the stats that are not necessarily taken to heart is that it was a particular study where it was men who were interviewed, and as long as they didn't use the word rape, they admitted that they did it. You can't use the word. You can't use that word. You can't use assault.
No. You can't use, quote rape or quote, but if you define it, the legal definition, if you describe what's happening, they will, they'll self-report. It was a LESAC study. David LESAC study is the one you're talking about. And it was, there's an excellent post on a blog that is one of the reasons also I'm still here today, is because of the Yes Means Yes blog. It's yesmeansyesblog.wordpress.com. I highly recommend your readers to read everything Thomas has to say, as well as some of the other authors on that site. He is my hero. That's the things that the way he articulates things. It's the first time I heard the phrase social license to operate, I heard it from him, and he talks a lot about this. He has this excellent post called Meet the Predators, where he talks about and examines this LESAC study that you were talking about, where, yes, they will self-report. You know, if you say, have you ever raped a woman? They'll say no. If you say, have you ever not taken no for an answer and kept needling and pushing and begging and pleading until she gave in, then many, many people will say yes, and that is indeed coercive rape.
And the men who are not like this, I do feel bad for them, but like you said, we don't want to blame bystanders or anything, but there are plenty of men who will speak up, and the he for she thing.
Oh, I love it.
I love it, but at the same time, with the girls in Florida that I was just talking about, their last names are Ball and Magnum. Mm-hmm. The one funeral for Tisha Ball is today, in fact. Mm-hmm. I have all of those men that I've seen in our literary community posting about he for she and standing up and they're one of us and all of that. None of them have talked about this Florida case.
Mm-hmm. No. Well, I think he for she is, I think it's a great idea, because I think that the idea behind it is, it's number one, to start dismissing this myth that feminists are men haters, number one.
Absolutely.
You know, because that's just ridiculous. I even, in class the other day, we were talking about, I had him read a piece by Jessica Valenti, and one of my students said, does she hate men? And I'm like, no, she doesn't. You know, but it's like one of those myths that the patriarchy, that rape culture has put on feminists, because we speak about male sexual violence, that somehow we hate men, which is not the case at all.
And that's why, if we can even, you know,
if
the world, like, you know, Emma Watson had said, if the word feminist bothers you, then don't use it.
Yeah, they don't use it, yeah.
If you really are bothered by the fact that people say men, mm-hmm, you know, do this, then say misogynist.
Yeah, say misogynist, exactly.
Be misogynist, yeah, too. They're trained. Mm-hmm. They're trained from birth.
Mm-hmm. Oh, they are. Oh, yeah, they are.
That these things are allowable.
Right, absolutely.
Those are cultural distinctions, depending on, you know, where you are. But it's just a matter of how you're raised. So, you know, misogynist can certainly be female, and we have more than one gender.
Oh, my goodness. I'll tell you right now that the most vocal people speaking out against me when I spoke out about my assault, the most vocal, cruel people were women, not men.
I'm not surprised.
No, I'm not surprised either.
I'm not at all surprised.
No, so it's by no means only men. In fact, but my greatest supporters were men. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I had a few women supporters, I only had a few supporters, period. But, you know, a few women supporters, a few men supporters. But the ones who publicly spoke out against me were women. What, so, the two people, in fact, those three conventions that I told you about. The two who were like, oh yeah, but our hands are tied, both of those organizers were women. And the organizer who was a man at Steampunk World's Fair, who's like, okay, we won't have him back, was the man. The other two were women.
That's good. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's I'm glad that there are conventions that are willing to step up.
Yeah, hopefully there'll be more in the future, because until we hold these perpetrators accountable. You know, and all I've ever asked was an admission, and I've said that he did not have, I mean, you could read a blog post I have on the omgray.wordpress.com about, will I accept an apology, was that he admit what happened. He doesn't have to use the word rape. He doesn't have to use the word assault, you know, but admit the behavior, admit the treatment, admit the damage. Apologize to me sincerely, privately, as well as publicly, because of how far it had gone, as well as make some kind of attempt at at making amends, of accountability. That's all I've ever asked. I've not asked him to turn himself into the police. You know, I've not asked him. I've asked for accountability is what I've asked for.
What's been sticking in my head, though, as we've discussed your case, is that you had heard from other people that you're not the only victim. And
of this certain person, I know that there's other complaints. I haven't heard any specifics about another sexual assault, but I've heard other complaints of discomfort or of poor behavior, poor choices in public. You know, I haven't heard any.
So I think it is indicative of repetitive behavior.
Oh, absolutely.
That's why when it comes to conventions and booking people, the reason that I wanted to bring that up in particular was in the comic book community. There was a very well-known creator who suddenly was getting just dragged through the ringer again for something that happened 7 or 8 years ago by another creator. And she said that he harassed her, you know, no matter how many times she said no. They were alone in a hotel room, and he kept promising her that he would help advance her career. And she, you know, everybody was wondering, well, why are you talking about this now if you guys came to terms years ago? Because apparently they did, and she, whatever, let it go. And she said that the reason that she was talking about it again was because she had begun hearing so many other stories.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's because you have the support.
And so
it's because you have the support, and because sometimes...
Like, stop booking this guy.
Yeah.
If, you know, you want to get into the he said, she said argument, that's one thing. But now you're talking about five she's, you know.
Right. Well, exactly. But, you know, and that's the same thing it takes a while sometimes, especially if it's not stereotypical, brutal stranger rape. It takes a while to process it sometimes and understand what's happening, especially with people who have a history of abuse,
right? She had to ask me.
I had to be told. I told a friend of mine what happened, and they're like, "Whoa, whoa, 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 whoa! That's assault." I'm like, "What? In fact, because it wasn't." And the other thing is what people don't understand is that once you've been a victim of sexual violence, you are 50% more likely to be a victim a second time. And once you're a victim a second time, you are like 75% more likely to be a victim a third time. Because it is a traumatic event that affects one's nervous system and the way one processes information just to cope with and deal with the assault. Because even like with the assault with Elemental, even though I didn't define it as sexual assault for many months later and didn't define it as rape for a couple of years, and you know, until I really understood the complete spectrum of the way rape can manifest, you know, even though the events didn't change, the language I used around it changed as my understanding, you know, evolved. But, you know, being raised, I mean, I'm about to be 45, okay? So being raised in the 70s and the 80s, where, I mean, think about it. When you see a little boy tug on a little girl's hair or push her down or tease her or make fun of her, what do you say?
They say boys will be boys.
Boys will be boys, or he's just doing that because he likes her, right? And it's the same kind of thing. Say they're around 12 or 13, you know, and he's making fun of her, he's pushing her around, and he's, you know, with his friends or whatever, and everyone's like, oh, that's just because he likes you, honey. Don't, you know. Or boy, oh, I'm so sick of the boys will be boys bullshit. But yeah, it's just like this. But then all of a sudden they're 16 and 17, pushing girls around, pulling their hair, tugging at their dresses, and all of a sudden it's not okay. Well, you've just told both of them that it's acceptable behavior for the last 15 years.
Right. And then the laws don't help. There's Massachusetts, luckily, very quickly changed their law, but Texas allows...
Yeah, imagine that.
Texas allows upskirt photos.
What? Are you serious?
I'm serious.
That's one of the many reasons I left Texas.
because I had been hearing a lot of complaints about the New York subway system with, as women are walking up the stairs, men are like behind them and taking pictures under their skirts. Mm-hmm. And apparently they don't consider that assault because you've given up your right to expect reasonable privacy.
God.
You've given up your right to privacy because you're wearing a skirt. And it's like, you're wearing a skirt and you're covered. It's not like you're...
But that just is further proof of the misogynistic society in which we live, as well as the culture of rape that is perpetuated by these types of actions.
So it really, you know, it varies where, you know, we're all here in the United States, and it varies from state to state and from school to school and campus to campus.
Well, I can see why they wouldn't call it sexual assault if no one is actually touching. You know, assault is generally much more of a physical interaction, but I definitely would consider it sexual harassment or exploitation.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's sad to hear that, like you're saying, that boys are taught this behavior and they're taught that it's okay, yeah, and that the laws are on their side.
Oh, yeah, well, and as important as that boys, you know, are taught from, you know, that sex is something that they have to pursue and that they have to get, and they are not men unless they do, you know, and all these kind of things, women are socialized similarly. Women are socialized to, you know, to kiss relatives they don't want to kiss, right? Or to hug people when they don't want to hug them. Or if a boy is acting in a certain way, you know, that's just the way it is. Oh, just, you know, boys will be boys. Or just let it go, sweetie. You know, it's not a big deal. And it's continuously minimized. And if you take just normal social behavior like that, you know, that's minimized, any kind of assault. I mean, when, you know, the statistics for sexual assault and rape is, it ranges somewhere between 1 in 3 to 1 in 6, depending on what study you're looking at, and that's women. And men is really right around 1 in 6 will suffer some kind of sexual violence in their lifetime. And I think both of them are actually higher if you look at the full spectrum of sexual violence. Because look in junior high, if you snap someone's bra, or if someone's groping you, or grabbing your breast, or grabbing your ass, that's sexual assault, people. That's exactly what that is.
Yeah, and you know, now hopefully they take those things more seriously.
Well, I'm hoping that they are, but you know, that's what I'm saying is if me, you know, going on 45 here in the 80s, I mean, the type of comments that were made to me on a daily basis, the being objectified and sexualized, being groped and from grades, you know, from middle school on, and especially, I mean, like I was telling you before about my professor and the way that, you know, everyone responded to the way people responded to that, the way boys, you know, it's always like, okay, well, they're going to do whatever, and it's up to you to protect your virginity or protect your whatever. You're the gatekeeper, you know, and they're just going to keep trying. You know, once you're socialized in this way to not even call it for what it is, then the line becomes very blurry indeed. When the line's not blurry at all, actually, you know, you're either into it and you're consenting or you're not. If you're saying no, whether you're like, no, stop, or no, get off me, those are both no's.
Right.
Those are both very clearly no's. Even if you're not verbally saying it, okay, even if you're just pushing someone away, if you're pushing their hand away, not helping them lift your shirt up, then that is a no.
Anything, I think it's one of the petition websites, whether it's change.org or some other petition website. There's one current right now looking for signatures in the UK to enhance their sexual education classes to talk about consent and relationships, mm-hmm. because they said, you know, it's one thing to talk mechanically and medically about sex, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. all genders need to have explained to them what is a healthy
right.
interaction.
Well, and I read that, I think there was something on the Yes Means Yes blog, but I've read other ones as well recent, is that the talk about consent doesn't start with sex. You start talking about consent when they're toddlers playing with each other's toys and, right. you know, taking a toy away from, you know.
And yeah,
you start talking about consent way before sexualizing it, you know, way before any type of sexual behavior comes into play. And then it's no longer this huge talk where, okay, you know, guess what? Everything we've told you for the last 15 years, forget that, because now the rules have changed. You know, it's about personal space. It's about establishing and respecting other people's boundaries. It's about not forcing someone to do something they don't want to do, whether it's sexual or otherwise.
Yeah, I can't imagine, you know, going through those years with the internet. I mean, because I'm about the same age.
I can't imagine either, no.
But, you know, like
accessible as porn is now to...
Yeah, the thought of the fact that the first threat for anybody is, well, we're going to, you know, release your sex tape or your nude photos. Mm-hmm. I'm like, well, at this point, I can happily say, well, I've already released my own.
Yeah,
so
I have plenty of naked pictures on the internet.
Yeah, I'm like, just whatever.
Just from Burning Man, yeah.
Like, you can't hurt me that way.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, yeah, exactly. You can't, it wouldn't hurt. If someone said they were going to release naked pictures of me, it's like, yeah, go ahead, whatever.
Yeah,
you know. I'm not ashamed of my body. You know, you're the one with the shameful behavior here, not me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I feel bad for the women who aren't like that.
Well, yes, because and there was a really great article about Emma Watson. You know, the whole thing turned out to be a hoax, but that's not the point. The point isn't that it was a hoax. The point is that the threat made a difference. The threat was meant to shut her up because she's a woman. If it was a man, it never would have been
surfaced. I've never been threatened. I've never heard somebody say, you know, oh, we're going to release Chris Pine's naked pictures. Oh, my God.
Right, right.
Tragedy.
It is a way to keep women silent and in their place.
Yeah. I mean, that's so it's very, very gender-based. Mm-hmm. And that's what I think a lot of people have a hard time grasping. Mm-hmm.
Which is exactly what a lot of legal threats are as well. They are designed to silence.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a bully designed to silence, you know.
But I think, you know, even when it takes a different route and, you know, you criticize a comic book cover and somebody then starts to hack into your bank account. Mm-hmm. I mean, come on.
Honestly,
I mean, art is allowed to be judged.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Certainly not by women, it seems.
Well, yeah. I don't think so. As you know,
when you start to look at these kind of things and you realize that men are not treated in the same way or not reacted to, you know, the reaction to their behavior is not the same way. That's when you really start to see the underlying misogyny. That is so, it's like the air we breathe. It's like a fish waking up one day and go, huh, I'm in water. It's so pervasive and all around us that you don't see it unless it directly affects you.
Yeah. And that's, you know, very often cases when it comes to body issues and body rights is it's not their problem.
No,
and yet they're allowed to dictate, you know, the politicians are allowed to dictate what you do.
Right.
And you know, these things are not their problem.
No.
It's not their burden.
Well,
you know, take care of your health care, but they're going to do what you can do and what you can't.
Well, and back to even the, you know, what we were talking about a moment ago about, you know, women like your friend asking you, was this assault? You know, or people having to tell me. I mean, because there was another incident after the one with Elemental, which was the one that really kind of crippled me, was my boyfriend at the time in Austin, who raped me. And that was really kind of what shattered me completely there. Anyways, long story, but, and the way the community and the way the police behaved, I mean, the same kind of stuff, but it was after that assault, that my husband was just like, you know, I think you might have PTSD because, you know, my behavior had changed so much, you know, and I started going to a therapist and ended up starting going to like a PTSD specialist and told her what happened. And this was like 5 months after the assault. Told her, you know, explained to her what happened. I said, you know, I think it might be borderline assault what he did. And she goes, oh, honey, there's nothing borderline about that. That was rape. And it was the first time anyone put that word to it. And I remember just being rendered speechless. And I'm like, it was what? No, it couldn't, you know, he loved me. It couldn't have been that. And I remember it being a very sobering moment and a very traumatic moment too, you know, of really accepting, oh my God, that's what that was. And then starting to do research on rape and sexual assault and reading other survivor stories and so forth. And it was, you know, I'd already called what had happened with Elemental sexual assault by that means, but it was about another 6 or 7 months after that when, as I was recovering, you know, out of the suicidal ideation after the Austin rapist was stalking me at Burning Man, after these kind of things that I'm like, you know, after I had to leave my job in the city. I mean, I haven't really been able to go back to Texas since, because as soon as I land in Texas, the hypervigilance starts, and I'm looking over my shoulder everywhere I turn, to, you know, wondering if I'm going to see him, just being in the same state, you know, as him. And so, I remember starting going, it's like, oh my God, what happened with him? What happened with Elemental was also rape. It wasn't just sexual assault. I mean, just, but it was also, you know, it was legally rape. And I had, and I reported him. I mean, I could say his name because it's a matter of public record. You know, it's on police. NYPD has a police report of the assault, in New York with Paul. And it's, you know, it's, they flew to the other side of the country, even though it was a year and a half. It was about a year and a half after the incident. And I told them that over the phone. I'm like, look, I know it's been a year and a half. I know you're not going to be able to prosecute. I know you're not going to be able to do anything, but I want it on record in case someone else comes forward, you know, that there is a record of it. So it shows. And I did the same thing with the rapist in Austin. You know, I knew they couldn't prosecute. I knew there wasn't enough physical evidence. You know, I knew it was 5 months later before, you know, I even reported it, then they couldn't do anything, because it took, you know, it was that long to just kind of work through the trauma to think clearly enough and have not one, but eight separate sexual assault professionals say, oh yeah, that was rape, including a lawyer, you know, including a sexual assault attorney. And said the same thing about, you know, about the assault with Elemental. And he's like, oh yeah, yeah, that's rape. And so it's like first being able to recognize this and being able to recognize it soon enough that maybe something can be done about it legally, although that's generally not, seeing as how only 86% never even make it to trial, 86% of reported cases, of course, and only about 40% are reported. So, you know, the odds are very, very much against us. But also, those kind of things are going to change once we culturally step up. And that's where things like him for her, or is it he for her?
He for she.
It's like he for she, or it's on us. Those kind of things are going to help the police, first of all, not dismiss it and cover it up, you know, and not minimize it, you know, and just put it off as some miscellaneous incident because they can't prove it and they don't want their numbers, you know, to show that they can't, you know, prosecute even the ones, you know, even more than they already show that they can't prosecute, you know, a sexual assault. But because the definitions are there. I mean, the definition of rape, the legal definition of rape in Texas completely is fits into my experience with the auctioneer there, and also in New York, for sexual assault and rape in New York is exactly, you know, my experience with Elemental is exactly what happened there.
Don't they use the FBI definition now?
I think in states, the FBI, yeah, just recently updated rape, which was,
yeah, it was
very nice, yes, because it was so, my goodness. Yeah, so it's definitely, but, and each state, because some will not have, it won't be rape. Everything is just under sexual assault. You know, so it'll be like legally called sexual assault, but so every state has it defined like a little differently, but they're fairly similar. I mean, I haven't, you know, done research on all 50 states and what constitutes a sexual assault or rape or sexual violence or, you know, or intimate partner violence or anything, you know, but what you find is that, once the communities, once your friends and your communities and, you know, the conventions or your church group or your school or the university, the number of rapes that universities cover up, you know, these kind of things, once that starts to change, then you'll see more prosecutions because you will have the support of the people. You know, right. It was the same. I mean, look back at like equal rights, right? Look back at equal rights and the end of slavery and the way that, you know, where people of color got their legal rights decades before they were actually really seeing any difference.
Right.
And it was when culture started to no longer accept, I mean, not that racism is gone by any means, but when they no longer would accept racial slurs in professional places, in communities. I mean, if someone was being outwardly racist, people would be like, that guy's an asshole. We're not going to have him back. Okay. And when people start doing that to those who come out and speak out against sexual violence, and or they see misogynistic behavior or some kind of coercive behavior, they see some guy trying to spike someone's drink or girl trying to spike someone's drink, or they see someone trying to get someone drunk enough to where they're no longer, you know, able to consent, but, you know, so they're more easily, quote, seduced. And boy, do I hate how that word has been what that's been a euphemism for so long, because it's really killed the word seduction for what it actually means. And, you know, when that starts to happen, that's when we're going to see more prosecutions. That's when we're going to see less assaults to begin with, because we're no longer allowing them in right. our societies. We're no longer, I mean, just the mere mention of it will be enough to go, yeah, you know what? I don't want to take the chance. I don't want him at our parties.
And this is, you know, again, part of that cultural shift is people like yourself, you know,
well, thank you.
Being willing to help and talk about it and, you know, get involved in the advocacy and the awareness campaigns and all of these things. And, you know, like when you think about epic, really epic cases like the Penn State Sandusky,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that man was abusing children for decades.
Who you don't expect, you know. It's like the ones who seem really creepy and really, you know, the ones who are being overtly so, the ones where someone said, oh, so and so did something to me and he's like some creepy guy, that they'll believe it. It's the charming ones, the funny ones, the ones who you would never expect, because that's how they continue to get away with it.
Right.
And so, you could even look at like serial killers, like frickin' Jeffrey Dahmer, you know? I mean, what did everyone say? Oh my goodness, he seemed like such a nice guy. Oh, he was always so charming. Oh, he was always, you know, that's the way they get away with it. So we have to start believing when people say it. I mean, I'm not saying condemning, I'm not saying ship off to, you know, to prison. I'm saying to start believing when people come forward and are talking about their experiences, to start believing them and start to have that questioning eye on the accused and not on the survivor.
Absolutely. I mean, thank you for all that you've been willing to speak on. Before we wrap up, though, I wanted to, you know, get an update from you. What is, you know, what are your plans? Are you going to continue writing as Christine Rose? Are you going to just try a different career instead?
I'm teaching at a community college again, which was the job I had to give up when I left Austin to get away from my rapist there. And so I finally found another position. I'm very happy in the classroom. I will probably write, I may try to write some academic articles. I'll probably be writing more nonfiction. I really don't have a whole lot more to say, I guess, at the moment when it comes to fiction or fantasy, because a lot of that was killed for me, was, I guess, raped for me, if you want to put it that way. And it's very difficult for me to concentrate with the PTSD anymore, so it's difficult for me to read fiction. It's difficult for me to read really pretty much anything unless it has to do with these topics, you know. In fact, one of the things I've been very excited about, when I was just in London this past summer, I got a reader's card at the British Library, which was wonderful for me, and I was able to read some articles like from the Victorian era and such. And there was a woman that I mentioned in Avalon Revisited, and she also plays a part in Avalon Revamped, named Mary Jeffries. And Mary Jeffries was just someone who, you know, I came across in my research, had several brothels, you know, in the Victorian era. And Arthur in Avalon Revisited goes to her Chamber of Horrors brothel, which was known for a more sadomasochistic taste. But through my research, you know, one of the things that were mentioned, just briefly mentioned by this woman, was that she was part of an underage sex white slave trade, where she would steal young girls and basically force them into prostitution. And so I've been become intrigued about this woman and finding out more about her. And while I was there in England, I uncovered some more research around this woman, as well as Inspector Minahan, who was the one police officer who was going to stand up against her and like this entire ring, and lost his career because of it. And I find it very interesting because we're talking about something that happened almost 150 years ago. And the things that were said, the things that were reported in the Pall Mall Gazette in by Stead and in some of the other newspapers there, you know, Stead did a whole, William H. Stead did an entire series on the Modern Babylon. It was a Modern Babylon is what it called, the Maidens of Modern Babylon series, where he was uncovering this this ring, this child prostitution ring that Mary Jeffries was a big part of. And of course, you know, he ended up in a sting operation to uncover, you know, exactly what was happening. He ended up being charged and put in prison, because this is what happens to people who speak out against sexual violence. Because the people who are perpetrating and participating in the sexual violence are generally very powerful and pillars of the community, very charming, you know, these kind of things. And so the people who speak out against them are the ones who are often punished, which is why a lot of people stay quiet. And Stead was punished, and so was Minahan punished. And some of the things that were reported in the court documents, as well as in the articles, is exactly what's happening today, almost 150 years later. Nothing has changed. Community responds to sexual violence the exact same way. Community punishes the people who speak out in the exact same way as they did 150 years ago. And so I find this very fascinating from a cultural standpoint, and also, you know, from a survivor and activist, you know, against sexual violence standpoint. And so it's probably something I'm going to look at a little bit more, and maybe write an academic article, if not a book, on this connection, you know, from this woman that I found just through some silly research, you know, during an erotic vampire steampunk fantasy book. So that's probably where I'm heading next. I'm not going to write under O.M. Gray anymore. I'm not going to probably write any steampunk anymore. If I write fiction, it'll be quite some time. I mean, last year I wrote three novels last year alone. And so it's going to be a while, probably, before I write anything else. And, I think I'm just taking a different road. People who haven't found me yet have 11 novels and about 30 short stories they could read before they're going to want anything new, you know. So I've got some time if I continue, you know, if I decide to do that. I certainly encourage any new readers to reach out. I still respond to blogs under the OM Gray blog, as well as to the wearawhitefeather.wordpress.com blog. I still respond to those. I'm just not going to really be promoting myself as an author under either name, really, and certainly not under OM Gray ever again, and not under Christine Rose probably for a while.
Yeah, it was. It's one of the things. Well, since you've written under different names, maybe you know the answer. I was wondering, when it comes to systems like Amazon, where you have author profiles, and like if I were to type in your name, would it only bring up?
Yeah, it would only bring up one of them. Unless you like read like my profile or something, where it'll say that, you know, also writes under O.M. Gray or something. They're not connected, although I'm thinking of one of these days when I have the energy and the time, I'm thinking of going in and like putting both authors' names on both works, you know, so it shows up on both author profiles. So I'm wondering, you know, maybe about doing that, but I'm not too terribly concerned about it right now. That part of my life, I think, is pretty much over. It's just been, you know, I like I said earlier this year with the Steampunk World's Fair, I really thought that there might be a renewal of that part of my life, and that I might be able to, you know, continue and speak out on these kind of things as well as write under O.M. Gray. But after the whole thing with the apology and which you could read about on my blog if you want. And I'm just like, you know what, I'm done. And anytime I write about OM Gray, I feel like I'm just opening myself up to further attack and further judgment. And I feel, you know, everyone, anytime something new happens with Professor Elemental, people think that they need to tell me about it. And I don't want to hear about it. I don't want to hear his name. I don't want to see his name. I want to forget he exists, if at all possible, you know, and because nothing's going to change, and I'm just sick of hearing about it, and so I've left.
Well, I'm really glad to hear that you went back to, you know, public speaking at least, and working in a classroom, because it's something that you're talented in, and it would really be such a shame if any of those people took that from you.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, a lot was taken from me, that's for sure. Thank you very much for acknowledging that. I do feel pretty confident in public speaking. I am pretty good at it. I'm not nervous. I've done it so much for so long now, you know, I'm pretty good at those kind of things. And I do enjoy being in front of a class again and, you know, getting them to start thinking about things, you know, in unique ways and introducing them to things they may not have been otherwise. Yeah. And there may be a time, you know, I mean, if someone asks me to come speak, I'm not going to turn them down, you know, I'll be happy to come do it, but I'm not going to seek it out anymore, if that makes sense. You know, I'm not going to promote myself in that way. If someone comes across my writing and, you know, or whatever, and says, oh, we'd love to have you come speak, I'd love to.
Okay. So you don't have anything scheduled then for now?
No. I was going to go to, I was going to be a part of a panel at New York Comic Con. I was invited with Eileen the Peacemaker, as well as some others, who's a wonderful, wonderful woman colleague, who invited me, wanted to, because she appreciates my voice and she's been a supporter, you know, through all of this. And I was going to do it, and I ended up just between the financial burden of doing it as well as the emotional burden of preparing for that and, you know, knowing that I'm opening myself up to attacks again, that I'm just like, yeah, you know what, I just don't want to do this anymore.
Okay. Yeah, I will. I'll be in and out at New York Comic Con. I'm not doing any panels actually at the show. I'm doing a reading with a great group of people. The event is called Queercopia.
Awesome.
We're going to be doing some LGBTQ readings at the Bureau for General Services Queer Division. Mm-hmm. So it's outside the con, but it's the Friday night during Comic-Con. So it's should be a very interesting, very new experience for me. So I have that going on. And but before that, we have October 4th and 5th at Comic Fusion in New Jersey is our superhero weekend, where we auction off comic book art and pages. We do raffles and we have all kinds of fun. Tons of cosplayers are coming, and we have artists that are coming, and that is our 2-day benefit for Safe and Hunterdon, which is our local domestic violence shelter. So people, if you have sat and listened to all of this and you want to help stop violence against women, then please help us out with Superhero Weekend. The online bidding has started, so you can go to comicfusion.com and click on, we used to call it Wonder Woman Day, so the link still says, still on the page still says Wonder Woman Day.
Mm-hmm.
So just click on that and you can see all of our pages of things that are up for sale, and we've raised around $47,000 over 7 years, so we're on our 8th year.
Excellent. How wonderful.
Yeah.
Well, and yeah, and I'd like to leave your listeners with something as well. If any of you are in an abusive situation, or if you are a survivor of sexual violence, feel free to write to me. You can write to me right through the omgray.wordpress.com blog. I have survivors writing to me all the time, looking for support, looking for solidarity. And if you are afraid to come out to anyone else and talk about what happened, you can certainly do so safely with me. I will believe you, and I will support you. I've been through it. I know what it's like.
Thank you for that offer. Sometimes that's the first step, is, you know, speaking some way, in some way, shape, or form, communicating.
Absolutely. And I encourage all your listeners to, in your communities, when you hear of an instance of sexual violence, believe the person saying it. Believe her. Believe him. Believe that this is happening. And that alone helps heal so much. You are contributing to the healing when you believe them, when you question them, when you interrogate them, when you, you know, that is just further traumatizing. That is causing secondary trauma. So just believe them. And if you have any questions, turn to the accused and ask them those questions.
Great advice. Great. Well, thank you so much, Christine, for, you know, for all your time and your effort for being here.
Well, thank you for having me, Amber. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
You guys have been listening to Vodka Clock. And if you do so through iTunes or Stitcher, please remember you can give like a thumbs up or some kind of rating there. You can follow me on Twitter at Elizabeth Amber and at amberunmasked.com. So thank you, everybody, for listening, and go forth and be safe and be good to each other. Cheers.